Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the TT Podcast. It's Tokyo time, and just like that, the road cycling is over, and we've got a new batch of Olympic champions. Joining me to discuss how the races were won and lost, and maybe even try to blag a little bit of mountain bike chat, is my co-host Tom. Tom, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's been almost 3 days since I've seen you now, so we had a little surprise meet-up over the weekend that the listeners will, I'm sure, be delighted to hear about. And to discuss at that point, this was on... Right, so I'll explain to the listeners. Tom and I met for a pint on Sunday night for the first time since we've started recording this podcast together. We're back over Zoom now, but I was in London over the weekend, where we sat down to discuss what had happened in the Olympics up to that point. And now we're going to carry on and probably repeat that conversation and cover the rest of what's happened since then as well.
There you go. Yeah, slightly less beer fueled this time. Although, Tom, I've just seen you take a swig out of a 2-litre bottle of what looks like blackcurrant cordial.
It's an old Pepsi bottle, but there is blackcurrant squash in there now. Yeah.
The glass is no good for you, mate?
So I'm living in my grandparents' house, and they have very small glasses. My minimum measure, especially, I've just got off the treadmill, done a run and broken the treadmill by the looks of it, but we don't need to get into that. And I need to drink by the pint, even if it's not beer, even the blackcurrant squash has to be drunk by the pint as a minimum. And I've got loads of these 2-litre bottles lying around because I used to take them into work as well. I'm working from home now, but when I was going into the office, I used to take my 2 litres of squash in with me in the morning.
We won't talk about this very long, but you would take a 2-litre bottle of Pepsi, still intact with the Pepsi, you know, wrap around it.
There's no Pepsi. No. I'm not drinking 2 litres of Pepsi a day. I was filling it with squash. I wasn't taking Pepsi in.
And would you then, when you got to work, would you then decant it into a normal size glass that they have at work? Or would you sit at your desk and swig from that?
I'd sit at my desk and swig from the bottle.
That's amazing.
There is some method to the madness, at least. I hope that was a satisfactory answer.
No, it's good. I'll tell you what, Tom, in a world where we need to use our resources more and more,
I hate throwing out plastic bottles as well. I always try and reuse them. It's being responsible.
Yeah, just, you know, take them into work like climbers take along, you know, oxygen canisters and stuff.
I'd take my big tub of pasta and my big bottle of squash. Sometimes pasta, sometimes rice, but yeah, I prepare my lunches at the beginning of the week.
Right, look, this is too much of a tangent here. Let's go through the Olympic Games, Tom. We only get to talk about this once every 4 years, or 5 years in this case.
Five.
Yeah. This obviously being our first time talking about it.
Out on Twitter quite a bit for getting that maths wrong, didn't you?
Yeah, I did actually. people like to be pedantic, and no more so than on Twitter. Let's start from the top, where it started. Let's start there. Does that make sense? Are you happy to do that?
Yes, I am happy to do that, but you might have to remind me what happened first, because we've had quite a lot go on since then. It'll be the men's road race.
The men's road race won by Ecuadorian Richard Carapaz. I wouldn't say it was an upset. I think it was surprising. What do you think?
No, not an upset. Definitely not. Like, Carapaz is a Grand Tour winner. He's just spent 3 weeks, well, not competing for the Tour de France, but, you know, getting himself on camera at the sharp end of the race at the Tour de France, even if he was 5 minutes behind the eventual winner. And yeah, as we said, has won the Giro before. But would you have had him? Would he have been your pick to win that race before the race started? Probably not. Is he a surprise winner? Also probably not.
There you go. That was your analysis. I thought it was nice of him to send an homage to the only other Ecuadorian gold medalist, Jefferson Perez, by launching his attack with 25 kilometers to go. And Jefferson Perez obviously won the 20-kilometer walk in Atlanta 1996, which I thought was a nice homage.
Obviously, I think that was probably everyone's first thought when Carapaz made that break. Everyone was talking about Jefferson Perez, did you say?
Yeah, exactly. Perez. Yeah.
That was certainly, my mind went straight back to Jefferson Perez at Atlanta in 1996.
It was quite predictable, actually. I mean, if you're Pogacar, to not see that happening was clumsy. Pogačar went himself on the Mikuni pass. Now, I'm not sure if that was, you know, relevant to Slovenian Olympic history. But I thought it was interesting that he admitted in an interview afterwards that he thought he went too early.
Yeah, that is rare for him, because I didn't think going too early was something that really existed in the world of Tadej Pogačar. He, whenever he attacks, he makes it stick. And for him to actually display some sort of sign of weakness was so almost nice to see. It's nice to know he can be beaten, because that's not the impression that we've had over the last, not even 12 months. You know, in the last 9-10 months, he's been, whenever he's entered a race, he's been almost unstoppable.
Well, this is what I thought was interesting, and this will lead on to, I'm sure, when we talk about the women's road race, a larger debate about race radios. But I think part of Pogačar mistiming his attack there comes down to the fact that a lot of riders these days are quite reliant on their radios and being told, hey, this person's on the ropes, you need to go now. The riders essentially were riding on instinct in the road races this year, and Carapaz seemed to be the most instinctive.
Look, there's obviously a place for them in the peloton, and if they're allowed, you're going to use them. But I'm a bit tired of just hearing it as an excuse every time, because are these riders basically expecting to never have to think for themselves again?
I don't know. Look, I think there's a lot of place for radios. I think it makes the racing exciting. And
I don't think it does. I thought what we saw in the women's race was far more exciting than any race with radios.
Pure chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an anarchist.
Okay. Before we talk about that, let's have a word on Wout van Aert. Now, Wout van Aert had to go very deep. When eventually he decided he would start pulling on the front of the group, he took 30 seconds off Carapaz and McNulty over 2 kilometers. Now, that to do that effort and then come second in the sprint was phenomenal. Tom, I'm going to ask you a question here. Do you think Wout van Aert's sprint strength is also his biggest weakness?
In the sense that it means he gets marked out of every move ever.
Exactly.
Yes. Because as soon as he's there, if that group wants to get to the line, he's going to have to do all the pulling. There's been plenty of other riders who have got a very sharp kick at the end of a race, but can also get themselves over the lumpy bits. Peter Sagan's the one who comes to mind. As soon as he was in a group, that was just the end of it, because no one else was going to pull and he wouldn't do it on his own just to wear himself out at the line. And I remember, you know, that countless times that's happened at Grand Tours, well, the Tour de France mainly, but certainly I'm seeing, yeah, parallels there. Although I think Wout van Aert probably arguably better at getting over the climbs than Sagan, and arguably quicker on the flat than Sagan as well. So
I think what this has shown, though, is that the international setup is quite bizarre, in the sense that you end up at the end of the race. And I'll tell you what, I wish we had it more often, because it's fascinating and tactically very, very different to kind of team road racing. You end up at the end of the race with scattered individuals in a group at the end, all tactically trying to outnoose each other, but they don't have, obviously, radios or anyone telling them. It's just their instinct. Whereas on the road, Wout van Aert probably would have had Mike Tournesen with him to drain off his resources first and then lead out Wout van Aert into the sprint. And he'd also have, you know, people in his ear saying, look, this is when you should go, and this is whose wheel you should be taking, and this is who's going to make their move now, and this is who's looking tired.
It's weird, and I think the course can play into that sometimes, because if you know the course is going to lend itself to a bunch sprint, you can come, if you're one of the bigger nations, you can come with just a big lead-out train for your sprinter. And obviously, you know, Cav winning the world champs springs to mind, things like that. And you'd think, you know, if the Belgians wanted to go all in for Wout van Aert, they've got the talent to, you know, put a group together to make that work. And I think, this is moving on to the women's race again. The Dutch turned up with the four best women in the world, essentially, on Sunday morning for that race. But there was just no teamwork there at all. They all seemed to be riding for gold for themselves against each other. And if it's going to be like that, then you've not got a chance, have you?
So I actually went back through our WhatsApp conversation, Tom, and found a message from you that you sent me a few days ago, saying, it was essentially saying, with the Dutch riders in that Dutch women's team, you said, why bother having the race?
Well, yeah, I stand by that comment. They probably are the top four riders in the world. They're just, you know, it was just sort of some sort of team suicide mission that they went on.
The race was won, obviously, by Anna Kiesenhofer, 500-1 at the start of the day. Now, that's Leicester City odds of winning that race. Brake went immediately. As soon as the gun went, as soon as the flag dropped, she's off. I think she said after the race that that was her kind of best shot, really. She thought, look, I've got no shot if I'm in the group. I'm never going to go anywhere in the group. No one's going to help me in the group. She went in the break and then got forgotten about.
And we never saw her again.
Very interesting. And what I think that setup did for the race was it created this, well, it created this race that was very tactically complicated. The Dutch obviously had this internal battle. They had to organize a chase. You had someone like Lizzie Deignan who was saying, look, this is up to the Dutch to do this. They didn't know what to do. They obviously, we found out after the race, they didn't know who was up the road. Before we come on to that though, let's talk about Anna Kiesenhofer. Now, Tom, how much do you know about Anna Kiesenhofer, or how much have you read about Anna Kiesenhofer after the race?
Right. She's Austrian. She's a mathematician stroke. She has a PhD in something, maths maybe. And that's about it.
Nice.
Oh, she didn't have a professional team. She hasn't rode professionally, sorry, since 2017.
She was also dead last in the Bucks 10-mile time trial in 2012. And to come from dead last in the British University time trials to first in the Olympic road race is incredible. You mentioned her being a mathematician. Very well-calculated move. Her PhD, Tom, stay with me. Her PhD was entitled Non-Communicative Integrable Systems on B-Symplectic Manifolds. Now, if we're going to talk about non-communicative systems, let's go with the Dutch.
Right. You've set that up nicely. I'll be honest, I've seen the Dutch teams in just about any sport, at any major international tournament, and this is what always happens. They all fall out with each other. They never communicate. Their own arrogance gets the better of them. And this is just going to be a horrible load of xenophobic cliches about the Dutch. But it happens every single time. And it's just fantastic to watch it all implode.
It was bizarre. And I think, I don't know if it wasn't, they weren't working together. I think they were kind of working together, but they obviously didn't have set who the leader was going to be. They didn't know whether they were riding for Van der Breggen or Van Vleuten. Van Vleuten then said, right, well, fine, I'm going to do my classic 50 kilometer to go attack.
I'll do it all myself then.
Yeah. She gets there. Well, doesn't really get anywhere with her attack. And then I thought she had. This is the thing. And I think with hindsight on that race, they probably thought they had executed that to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Because they reined in the two in inverted commas, riders that they thought were up the road. And then rode for Van Vleuten, who attacked at the end and took, presumably, the gold medal. They just obviously hadn't been counting back the riders as they were chasing in the break.
Yeah, you're right in that sense. It's probably unfair what I just said about them. I mean, it was unfair anyway, but it sounds even more unfair now because they probably did get together as a team and think they'd executed it perfectly. And they didn't really throw the toys out of the pram until after they crossed the finish line and realized what they'd done wrong.
Yeah. There you go. What was interesting about the women's race was after it, Cecily Trip-Ludwig of Denmark was very frustrated because she obviously saw it as being a big opportunity for women's cycling to show how great it is. And she felt that obviously the tactical mishaps was not a good advert for women's cycling. Do you agree with that? Or do you think maybe the discussion that it created was actually really good for women's cycling?
I can see where she's coming from. It doesn't, you know, make it look like the slick professional sport you expect it to. But, you know, anyone could have made that mistake. They obviously haven't forgotten how to count because they're women. So I don't think that's a great way to approach it. But yeah, you know, you're right. It does give a lot of exposure, that getting that clip of the person in second place riding across the line with their arms in the air. That'll do the rounds for years. And I mean, to be fair, I'm not sure which one Van Vleuten will hate seeing more, that or her going head over handlebars in Rio 5 years ago as well, when she also should have was like clean on for gold as well. So it's not been a good two Olympics for her, but a lot of media exposure.
Well, she made it up in the time trial. But I think you've tapped on it there, is that what it was is that women's cycling became very mainstream. And I saw a lot more discussion about the women's road race than I did about the men's road race. And that's really important going forward. I mean, it makes these names a lot more household for cycling fans. And if they're engaging with it, be that, you know, I mean, essentially what they're doing is, if we're engaging critically with women's cycling, then it shows that we're treating it in the same way that we treat men's cycling, which is exactly what we should be doing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about more communication issues with the Dutch.
I was hoping you'd say that.
When I say Mathieu van der Poel and the word ramp, or maybe ramp gate, what comes to mind?
I mean, I'm absolutely gutted. I'm not, because I'm also delighted that Tom Pidcock won the Olympic mountain biking gold medal, because he's the future of British cycling. But,
and crucially named Tom.
That is obviously the most important part, yeah. But I was all in for Mathieu van der Poel. He'd left the Tour early to concentrate on the mountain biking. He's there again doing his own thing, not bothering with the road, when you'd argue that he could have sailed past Carapaz on the road as well if he'd wanted to. And then he, yeah, bins it on a jumpy downhill section on the way to
Is this afterwards. How we're going to engage with mountain biking? Is it? This is how we're going to blag about it, on a jumpy downhill section.
Well, what do you call it? They went over like this rock face.
I think we're going to expose ourselves here as being road.
What's the terminology for when you jump over some rocks?
They've probably got a lot of slang for it. It'll be like, they'll say something like hooking a boulder or something, probably.
Oh, well, anyway, Mathieu van der Poel went head over his bars. He said afterwards he expected a ramp that was there during all his training, during all his recon, to still be there. He thought it would only have been taken out for the test event. It was taken out for the race as well. The Dutch coaches. The Dutch coaches have come out and said that he was told it would not be there for the race. And there's just your classic Dutch international tournament implosion. They all hate each other. It's Wesley Schneider and Ruud van Nistelrooy and whoever else all over again. Iron Robin, all hate each other.
Well, right. Let's just say, before we criticize Van der Poel and the Dutch, Tom Pidcock raced that flawlessly. He did not put a foot wrong. Well, if Van der Poel was in that race, I think he still would have been beaten by 20 seconds.
I'm not sure. It's Mathieu van der Poel. I just don't think you can ever make that claim. Okay. And it's a real shame we didn't get to see that race unfold.
That's true. I mean, I think we saw it anyway with, obviously, with Pidcock and the riders he was competing against. Names I do not know. there was a Brazilian guy and maybe someone from Switzerland. But they were good, I think. They were riding fast.
Let's move on to it. There were also three Swiss women in the women's event. But
that was phenomenal, actually. The 1-2-3 that they took. I was
it's
up
so
early
rare
for that
you
one
see
well.
A clean sweep of the podium in any Olympic event.
Yeah, and they, by way as well. I mean, the winner, Yolanda Neff, won it by a minute or so. And then, I'll tell you what was good, actually, to see, was that the second and third place riders, who, again, the names escaped me, they kind of battled it out, actually. They weren't like, there was no hierarchy in the team. They just kind of attacked each other and went for it.
Yeah, I get that. You would. At that point in the Olympic race, yeah, no. It's only silver and bronze, so no one really cares, do they? But when you're in that position, you probably would go for it.
Yeah. Let's talk women's TT then.
Let's. Annemiek van Vleuten.
Well, we're back on Annemiek van Vleuten. Try and be polite this time about the Dutch, because they've done something correct now.
I said I liked Mathieu van der Poel.
Yeah, you did.
I'm going to have to like put some sort of disclaimer on this and say I don't hate the Dutch. But
I'm very pleased for Van Vleuten. She was delighted after it. She did her celebrating a few days before, obviously, as we know. But she really deserved it. And I think if, you know, one thing that came out of that race was that how much what I'm going to refer to as the three H's, which is the heat, humidity and hills, played a part on that course. Very famous, yeah. Tom, the three H's of Tokyo.
Well, I know you've got some issues with the Fuji Speedway already, going back to some WhatsApps you sent me.
Should we talk about the Fuji Speedway, actually, before we get onto the time trial? What a bore of a circuit.
I like it. Well, this is, as I said this to you on Sunday night as we were chaining beers, that
I'm not. I think we had two beers over the space of an hour and a half. So,
as a Grand Prix circuit, I've always liked it. I used to drive around it, Gran Turismo, all the time on the PS3. So it's always, and you know, it's in Japan on the other side of the world. So it's always been. I think it's where. Have you seen Rush, the film, the F1 film about James Hunt and Niki Lauda?
No.
Great film. You should watch it. One of the Hemsworths, Chris, plays James Hunt, and it's the circuit where James Hunt won the F1, the 76 F1 World Championship, and so it's always had, and that season is just so famous for a number of reasons. We can turn this into an F1 podcast if you want to talk about Niki Lauda's crash at the Nürburgring. But
I'm letting you say everything you want about the Fuji Speedway, and I'm going to tell you all the reasons I do not like it. So
basically, James Hunt won the World Championship there in 76, and I used to drive around it on Gran Turismo, and it's got a really long straight.
Look, and you've identified the issue there, Tom. Long straights off F1 circuits do not lend themselves to interesting cycling races. I want markers at the side of the road that indicate how fast the riders are going. I want trees. I want signs. I want fans. I want whatever, inflatable things, you know, whatever. I want a big bike at the side of the road carved into the grass. I don't want just however many meters wide, 20, 30 meters wide. How wide is it? You probably know this.
How wide is it?
Yeah, whatever. Oh, I don't want a big wide asphalt landing strip for them to go down. It's boring.
There are some trees.
Okay. So I've just realized I have this thing, Tom, where sometimes what I do is somebody tells me something they really like and I tell them all the reasons I don't like it. And as soon as I do it, and unfortunately it always comes after I've done it, I realize that is a very impolite thing to do. And that if somebody did that to me, I'd be very upset. So I'm going to apologize because I can hear that you've obviously got some very fond memories of the Fuji Speedway.
I wasn't alive in 1976. It's all right. Don't worry.
Well, anyway, I apologize. I just, you know, I would like it to have, you know, a summit finish on Fuji or something, or straight into what's that busy bit in Tokyo called? You know, the bit with all the lights and the crossings, the zebra crossings.
I don't know.
Yeah, where they do do the slow-mo bits, or the like.
I know, but does it have a name? I thought that was just every street corner in Tokyo looks like. There's 30 million people in Tokyo. That could be anywhere.
Yeah, well, I want them blitzing through there. That's what I wanted. And I want Wout van Aert to win it.
A summit finish up Fuji. Is Fuji not an active volcano?
Exactly. Yeah. Good fun. That's a temporal marker. That's a marker at the side of the road, isn't it? A bit of lava or whatever.
Yeah, get that, you know, the typical shot of Japan. You've got the Mount Fuji with the cherry blossoms in front, which I think is called Sakura in Japanese. And then the bullet train comes past and you just go, yeah, that is everything Japan has in a nutshell.
Yeah. And then Primoz Roglic winning a time trial.
Past, you know, with the same speed as the bullet train.
Which he basically did today. What a phenomenal ride from Primoz.
I think he averaged 48K an hour. I saw someone tweet today on, you know, not a flat course. That's really quick.
Yeah, not only that, but he was the fastest at, I think, every single time check. So he obviously, whatever he had for breakfast, I want some of that. But I think it was just a matter of him avenging his demons.
Yeah, I haven't seen the splits, but he just rode away from everyone else. And if, as you say, he was the fastest at every time, but the gap grew and grew, which suggests to me, because I don't think everyone else got slower, because I think between second and fifth, there was less than 10 seconds. And the gaps between them were pretty consistent. And Roglic just rode away from the field over the second half of the course. That was an incredible piece of time trialing.
Well, I think ironically, I don't think we've seen a time trial performance like that, where the winner has won by such a margin to the rest of the field. I mean, he won by over a minute since the Planche des Belles Filles, where unfortunately he was on the other end of it. You mentioned there the second to fifth and the gap between second and fifth. Tom, I've got some numbers for you. Well, I don't have some numbers for you. I've stolen some numbers for you off Twitter.
Fire away. Go on. Do your statistics.
4 seconds separated second and fifth. Poor old Stefan Kung, who cannot
it's
seem
always
to...
poor old Stefan Kung. Always...
poor old Stefan Kung was less than a... I think he was 0.4 of a second off bronze. But that's not the number I wanted to highlight. What I wanted to highlight was that 4 seconds between second and fifth is the equivalent, according to a tweet from Javier Disley, is the equivalent of 1.2 watts of power. Now, that's 1.2 watts of power over a 40-kilometer time trial course. Tom, I've been running some more numbers for you. To put that into context, there was a study recently, or maybe not recently, there was a study that used wind tunnel testing and found out that shaving your legs alone can save you 15 watts over 40 kilometers of time trialing. That 1 watt between them is the equivalent of a very small patch of leg hair or a matter of, on the Fuji Speedway, picking a slightly shorter line around one of the corners.
Well, that was it. I think it was it Chris Boardman on commentary? I was watching on BBC, and he said if, I can't remember who it was who was coming through. Anyway, it was at the halfway point. They come along the straight. He said they've obviously got the barge boards at the side that line the start-finish area. And he said, you've got to get in close next to the wall, next to these boards, because that gives you an aero advantage. It increases the tailwind behind you, things like that. And it was interesting to see which riders were really taking advantage of that, getting up close. And I know you see, again, you see racing cars do this at these stupid American ovals. They're always right up on the walls. And you always wonder why. And it's because there's some sort of aerodynamic advantage to be gained there. And I remember this morning watching it, like, Filippo Ganna was middle of the road, just not bothering, just putting the power down. And the other guys were just getting as close as possible. And you can see who's done their homework and who hasn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know how much... Well, I guess Roglic has had a bit of time to do his homework, because I think the last time we saw him, he was mummified in bandages on his way out of the Tour de France. So he's obviously sat down, thought, right, how can I race this as quickly as possible? But yeah, phenomenal, phenomenal time trial. And I think he's... what he's done is he's purged this reputation that he's got recently off being a massive choke, because he held it. And more crucially, Tom, what he has done is, I think, given me my first ever correct prediction since we started this podcast.
I was wondering when you were going to bring this up.
Yeah, and my thing with Roglic is, what upsets me about Roglic is I think he is the best Grand Tour cyclist we have had in recent years. And it upsets me because I don't know if he will ever win the Tour de France. And I think you can't go down as one of the greatest in history without winning the Tour de France. And he's saying, well, you know what? I'll just win everything else then.
Great. I mean, that's... how recently are you saying?
Since Chris Froome.
Okay, good. Because he was obviously the first one I'm thinking of going. There's a few, but Roglic is, again, he's shown that sort of, not the same versatility as Wout van Aert, but, you know, he's turned up and embarrassed Julian Alaphilippe on the line at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which I know.
No need for mentioning that. There's just no need to bring that up every time.
It's completely relevant. It's Roglic showcasing his ability. Again, he's a great time trialist. He's a great climber, and he's capable of doing it in the classics as well. And that that win at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, we talked about as being that sort of redemption ride at the time, because that came immediately after the Tour, and that awful day for him on the Planche des Belles Filles, he embarrassed Julian Alaphilippe in his first race in the rainbow jersey at the time as well.
Why did you need to bring that narrative back into it? Look, let's just move on. Since the race this morning, Tom, I have been looking into explanations as to why your predictions, Filippo Ganna,
and famous Irish cyclist Filippo Ganna,
and Chloe Dygert did not win. And the explanation that I have landed on, Tom, is that they are both riding track as well next week. And they'll both be doing the individual pursuit. And I mean, that is a race that's like a 4-minute race. So I think it's very hard, and it might be confusing or difficult to shift your focus and your training coming from somebody that has never trained for an individual pursuit or a time trial, that it must be very difficult to, I mean, although the individual pursuit is classified as an endurance race, it's not as endurance as a 40 kilometer time trial, you know, 55 minute effort.
Again, I think
maybe
we,
there was that difficulty in judging the training or keeping it focused.
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this with Eleanor Barker, who will obviously be doing the team pursuit as well in the Velodrome. It is an endurance event in the same way that like the 1500 when you're on the athletics track is an endurance event, which again takes 3.5 minutes for the quick men, but it's a completely different endurance event to running a marathon. Hopefully that helps some non-cycling people understand.
I'll tell you what, Tom, I don't think non-cycling people have got this far into the podcast. Another thing I was looking for an explanation for was, where is Tadej Pogacar? Now, I found the answer.
I believe you. Are you going to get out that picture of him that was doing the rounds this morning?
Oh, and what, the one that is girlfriend? So yeah, I didn't really understand that. So Orla Chenoy and Bradley Wiggins were having a conversation, and I think Wiggins was basically alluding to the fact that he thought Pogacar was going to win the time trial that Pogacar wasn't competing in. And Pogacar's girlfriend tweeted a picture of him asleep on the sofa saying, not sure he's going to beat it this year, Bradley. But no, Slovenia only got one entry for the time trial. And I think Pogacar, with the last month and a bit that he's had, probably was quite happy to concede that to Primoz Roglic.
Given that they compete with each other for absolutely everything domestically and internationally, they seem to have a very good working relationship. And obviously, I think it's probably quite a nice trade-off to say, like, look, I'll take the Tour de France in the yellow jersey. You can have Olympic gold.
I think what it is about Tadej Pogacar is what I'm realizing the more I see him interact on Twitter and with people is just he is a fan of the sport and he loves the sport. And, you know, when the other guys were getting their medals in the road race, he was so happy just to be there and see these guys getting their medals, like joking on the podium. On Twitter, he'll congratulate people on their races. I think these are just his heroes he's riding with. Like Roglic, I'm sure he looks up to him just as like I would if I saw Primoz Roglic riding a bike.
He's also 22 and has probably got another 2 or 3 cracks at this.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, fine, have a go.
You have this one.
More detective work I've been doing, Tom. Team GB, right? I'll tell you what, this is something that I'm interested in your opinion on, and then we'll call it an evening. So did you know the time trial participants have to come from the road team?
What do you mean by the road team?
So for the cyclists, if you're competing in the time trial, you also have to be part of the team for the road race.
Okay, so, no, I did not know that.
So the Team GB road race team was Geraint Thomas, Theo Gegenhardt, and the two Yates brothers. So the time trial had to be two of those four riders. Now, there are much better British time trialists than those two. You've got, for example, Alex Dowsett, I think is the obvious one, former British champion. Then you've also got Hugh Carthy, who's been phenomenal in time trials recently. Both of them couldn't go because they were not part of the road team setup. That doesn't make sense to me because it's the equivalent for me of, if you're looking at jumping, for example, it's like saying, oh no, you can't do the high jump unless you do the triple jump as well.
Is there a reason why Hugh Carthy or Alex Dowsett couldn't just be put in the road team? If that's...
So yeah, I mean, Dowsett's obviously very active on YouTube and he was really hoping to go and he'd been practicing for it and training for it and he knew the course like the back of his hand. He had a discussion with British Cycling and they said, well, I think he realized that he couldn't help out as much as the others would in the road race. I don't know if they were hoping that they would get a result in the road race with G or something. Well, or
just sending, obviously it was a bit of a lumpy course.
Adam Yates got a top 10 in the end, didn't he?
Yeah. So is it just purely down to a selector's decision? They pick the team for the road race and they just have to work out the two between that?
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
But then I think actually Rowan Dennis was picked for the road race, but he didn't do the road race. I think he dropped out the day before and then concentrated solely on the time trial.
So that is allowed. I mean, obviously that was, is that something would you work that out with the federation? They say, look, we'll go a man short in the road race and then go all in with you on the time trial as a result.
I'll be honest. I think, like, you can probably just make something up and say you're not feeling it or you've got an injury and you want to rest it. Or
I know you could as an individual, but you know, your selectors and your federation and your teammates might be a bit pissed off if you know, you don't help out in the road race and then go and take the time trial medal for yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely an interesting debate, because I think there's been a lot of debate about, you know, revolutionizing cycling at the Olympics, and people are saying, you know, there's not enough medals for cycling at the Olympics, considering, you know, it's a field of however many 60, 70 riders that start, and only three of them can get medals. Now, I think they give out enough cycling medals at the Olympics, to be honest. But it's more just kind of making sure that we're getting the best of the best.
I know what they say. I mean, I know the argument. Obviously, you know, you can combine events a lot more easily in sports like swimming. You're very unlikely to be able to win the road race, the mountain biking, and a couple of events on the track in the same way that you can win. You know, if you're a good swimmer, you can do butterfly, backstroke, and breaststroke or whatever.
But I'd love to see Carapaz have a pop at the BMXing, though.
We can go back to, there's a lot of, as we know, good cyclists who, Cadel Evans is always the one, but was mountain biking world champion before he won the Tour de France and things like that. So there is that crossover. But that's over the course of a career, not over the course of a 2-week period at one Olympics.
Yeah. There you go. Well, hopefully, you know, someone like, we'll see Ganna and Diger do better on the track until the track cycling starts. Well, actually, when the track cycling is on, Tom, where can people find what we have to say about these races?
As always, they can go to @TTPDCST on Twitter or Instagram. That is TT Podcast with all the vowels taken out.
Perfect. Well, Tom, it's been a delight watching the Olympics. It's been a delight discussing them with you. Obviously, it was a pleasure talking to you in person in a pub recently. That was lovely. And hopefully we'll get to do that soon. But until then, thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll come back to you soon. Take care.
Thank you very much, everyone.